Inside the Boss Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always by Dave Franklin. We've got a couple of special guests from Emory University that we're going to be bringing at you in a couple of minutes. But first, Dave, it wouldn't be the MCLA podcast if we didn't start off talking about something other than MCLA lacrosse. And topic of the week, particularly I would imagine for you and sports fans everywhere, the Michigan Maize and Blue falling just short of an NCAA championship in the men's Final Four on Monday night. Great game. Obviously, a lot of excitement. What was it like, I guess, for a Michigan family to be watching that one?
It was really a great experience, Terry. It was really a great season for Michigan through and through. There were a lot of high expectations when Trey Burke decided to come back for one more season, and we just are continuing to see great strides under Dave Brandon's administration. A Sugar Bowl victory 2 years ago, an appearance in the Frozen Four a few years back, and now a Final Four to add to it. And, you know, it just does a lot of good things for Michigan basketball. It kind of washes out the bad taste that the Fab Five and the Chris Webber scandal left from the 90s. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, Louisville was just the better team down the stretch, and they're obviously doing an unbelievable job building a basketball dynasty there as both the men's programs and the women's programs took down the national title. And, you know, Terry, as an Ohio State fan, I hope you can appreciate this, because if Michigan's elevating their level, you know, it only does good things for Ohio State.
Well, I guess I'll have to take your word for it on that one. I gotta take an issue with the idea that the Fab Five left a bad taste in Michigan fans' mouth. I, not being a Michigan fan myself, I would say that my life would be worse off if it weren't for the Fab Five and not for those, you know, bizarre rivalry reasons, as it were. They were, you know, awesome to watch. But, you know, I understand that, you know, we've got a little bit of an Atlanta-themed podcast today, you know, talking to some folks from Emory, and obviously you spent some time there. Your sister's still down in Atlanta as well. How did a Franklin representation at the championship game end up working out?
It worked out pretty well. It would be dishonest of me to say that I was able to personally procure my sister some tickets. So to say the least, we had to call in a bigger favor from a bigger CBS personality to help her out. We couldn't actually get her into the Final Four. That was a tough draw with so many Michigan and Syracuse fans making the trip down there. But as it usually is, the Final Four, there's some ticket turnover going into the championship game, especially for what I would imagine for a lot of Wichita State fans. And yeah, my sister was actually able to go to the game. My girlfriend actually went to Syracuse, so we had some fun on Saturday night watching that one together. In the meantime, her brother went to Michigan and also made the trip down for the games. So it was definitely a fun weekend for our family. And I have to agree with you. The Fab Five is one of the best things to happen in college basketball. Black shoes, black socks, the talent that they had as freshmen, the things that they accomplished outside of the Chris Webber scandal. It was really a great time for Michigan athletics, to be honest.
Well, on that note, Dave, we're moving into, I guess, crunch time of most lacrosse seasons. Obviously, fans of varsity lacrosse are seeing it all throughout the NCAA ranks, and it's no less true at the MCLA level, but we're kind of pressing the pause button a little bit, and I liked your idea to take this angle at this point in the year, because, you know, for all of the efforts that are put in on the field, you know, there's certainly a tremendous amount of effort that's put in off the field by, you know, all these kids, and particularly in the MCLA, it's important to recognize that, you know, all these kids are going to college in order to advance their careers, in order to, you know, set themselves up for the rest of their lives, and lacrosse is only a small part of that. So you wanted to take a look at the academic component of the commitment that these kids made, and, you know, on that note, let's bring in, you know, coaches two fine Division II coaches at a fine Division II institution, your alma mater, Emory University. I guess, you know, I probably wouldn't be able to introduce them as well as you will, so if you want to take the reins on bringing them in, that'd be good.
No question, Terry. Carl Schmidt and Andy Cartenson took over this program last year under pretty difficult circumstances, as my former coach and Carl's former coach, for that matter, Dave Reed, phased himself out. The team had a difficult run last year, going 0-8, and you know, as we addressed on InsideLacrosse.com, we kind of made mention of that and how changing personnel, both from the coaching staff and players in this kind of a non-NCAA component league, can really cause some turnover. But, you know, Carl Schmidt and Andy Cartenson have just done an unbelievable job of turning this program around this year. They are now an SCLC playoff contender. They've won, you know, a slew of big games, a really impressive record to date. They work really, really hard together to make this work. They actually live together, you know, and balance their work schedules and their personal lives with lacrosse in order to bring it back into the home and, you know, keep things focused. So it's really my pleasure to bring in head coach Carl Schmidt and associate head coach Andy Cartenson onto the podcast today.
Thanks, guys.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us. And Carl, first question to you. So I understand you played as a grad student in 2011, and then, you know, as Dave just said, have recently taken over the reins. So you have a pretty good perspective on the trajectory or arc that this program's taken over the last two or three seasons. What would you say is kind of the biggest culture shock or change that the program at Emory has undergone?
Yeah, so for me, I think since Dave Reed had his unfortunate departure from the program, it's really been a change in attitude with Coach Carstensen and I taking over. We've really, going through that rough spell last season, really had to build a family-type attitude where everybody knows their role on the team and has to build from this we-before-me attitude and know that the team comes first. And so in doing so, they've all bought into this system. All the players have bought into this, and it really has helped our program move forward.
Andy, your alma mater, the University of Colorado, is arguably having one of the best seasons in program history, obviously preparing for the Rocky Mountain Showdown with none other than Colorado State. You know, in your eyes, as a former RMLC player and a current SELC coach, what is it that is pushing the RMLC forward as far as, you know, their place in the MCLA and, for that matter, maybe holding the SELC back a little bit?
Yeah, so first of all, go Buffs in the Colorado Rocky Mountain Showdown. I grew up in Colorado, and really it's a very interesting time being in the SELC currently to see kind of the progression of youth lacrosse. Basically, the Southern region is in the same position as the Rocky Mountain region just 10 years later. So guys that were kind of my age, I guess, mid-20s, were growing up playing lacrosse in the Rocky Mountain region and really progress the game there before it made it down south. So I see that the SELC is just a younger Rocky Mountain region. I think as lacrosse expanded in the country, the Rocky Mountain region seemed to be a little bit of a bubble, and the game just progressed so rapidly in that region, more quickly than it did down south. But I definitely expect the SELC to be on the heels of the RMLC coming up here in a few years.
And Carl, you know, we spent a fair amount of time there talking with Andy about his alma mater. We'd be kind of remiss not to do the same with you. And graduating from Davidson, a team which you guys play here coming up on April 19th, it would be a little bit of a homecoming. What are your thoughts? What kind of thoughts does that come to mind? Bring to mind? Is there any type of challenge or unique experience when it comes to playing against a program with which you're so familiar?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's going to be a lot of fun going back to Davidson and playing against those guys. Fuji Lozada is the coach there, and he coached me, and it's going to be exciting to play against him and coach against him. Both schools have high caliber academics, and so I think it's going to be a great matchup. And I, on a more personal note, talking with some of my former teammates, I think some of them are going to come in town and cheer on the Wildcats that night, and hopefully Emory will pull out a victory.
On that note, I just want to inform our listeners that Coach Schmidt is currently involved in a neuroscience behavior biology graduate program that, you know, you just spend just shy of a decade under. And, you know, Terry did a great job of giving credit to Emory's academic prestige. And we're going to talk about some really great student athletes throughout the entire MCLA in a bit. And I'm proud to be an Emory alum, but I just really want to give Carl some credit there for being so successful in the sciences, because truth be told, my GPA was just shy under 3.0 and I studied theater. So anyway, Andy, coming off of that note, Carl obviously had success as a grad student at Emory. You have two MBA candidates that are really pushing the team forward right now. How exactly did you find Ryan Douglas and Mike Embersit, the former Fairfield Stag, and how do they really how are they successful in balancing their schedules between college lacrosse and, for that matter, attending one of the best business schools in the country?
Yeah, so we what we've been trying to do as a coaching staff is promote the game around campus, and our team in particular. So they actually got word of the team through some avenue and reached out to us. We had a meeting with them, sat down, just described what we were all about, and they were on board. So, and that was in the at the beginning of the fall semester last year. So that's how we found them. And as it's, you know, as mentioned, the Emory, you know, university as a whole, both undergrad and graduate school, is one of the, you know, tops in the country. And I think the students that attend know what it takes to manage the time effectively. And that's what makes it so easy for them to, you know, separate lacrosse and school and also make time for it all. And being, you know, very intelligent, it's an easy transition. And with the time management skills, it's easy to get everything working together.
Carl, last time around this year, you know, Dave and I on the podcast, and Dave in the his notebooks, his weekly notebooks, you know, made mention of some of the struggles that had been going on surrounding the program, and the administration was quick to respond, you know, both on the kind of official athletic department side with Tim Downs, and on the club sports side with Andre Moore. What has that relationship been like this year? And, you know, have they taken any steps to help kind of support the program? And, you know, it's always an interesting relationship between, you know, a well-formed and kind of aggressive club sports program, you know, with the other aspects of both club sports and the athletic department on campus. How's that relationship formed over the course of the year?
Yeah, we have a great relationship with the athletic department right now. I meet with Andre Moore regularly, and we discuss all the ways that we can improve this program. And they're both huge supporters of our program and Emory lacrosse. I don't know if you guys know, but Tim actually played lacrosse in college and likes
Dartmouth.
Yeah, so, you know, he knows lacrosse and really wants to promote the sport, not just at Emory, but around the country. So, you know, they do the best they can to give us every consideration when it comes to promoting us as a club sport and, you know, trying to take us forward and continue our recent success.
Yeah, well said, Carl. Andre really does a great job of organizing that entire club sports department and really elevating the programs that travel and, you know, represent the university on a national basis. And Tim Downs' record as a player at Dartmouth and as an athletic director at Franklin and Marshall, where both the men's and women's teams have had unprecedented success during his tenure, very well noted. And, you know, coming off of that last question of the interview, we'll keep things light. And I think that I already know the answer to this question just because I spend way too much of my spare time watching cartoons. Andy, you know, I talked to your former teammate, current Colorado defensive coordinator, Marty Taffet, quite a bit. As I said, I think I figured this out, but Andy, why do people in Boulder call you Butters?
That's I'm not sure what Marty told you, but it could be anything. But my understanding is the TV show South Park obviously has a character named Butters who I guess physically resembles my appearance. I would like to say it's because I'm smooth as butter, but I think it's the other reason.
All right, well, fellas, that was great. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. As always, you know, Dave, for setting it up and certainly for giving us a little bit of a window into the club cross program at Emory.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, fellas.
And, Dave, we continue now with 10 burning rapid-fire questions. It's funny to combine the idea of burning and rapid-fire. Questions to close out the podcast, a little bit of a different format this week. We hope we can you know, get everybody on their way. But let's fire things up. And first one on the docket, what was the biggest surprise coming out of last weekend's results?
I think that's a bit of an easy one, Terry. Sonoma over Stanford, a 13-7 convincing win for the Seawolves, really stands out for me. This is a game that not only puts Sonoma pretty much at the top of the WCLL standings going into the postseason, but, you know, kind of has Stanford in an interesting position coming off of their loss to BYU. It looked like the Cardinal were maybe going for a perfect season, but Sonoma got 5 points apiece from Kyle Riddle and Ryan Heidrich. And the other thing that really stands out to me in this game is, despite the fact that, you know, Sonoma pretty much almost doubled up on Stanford is the fact that Stanford's senior captain and attackman Jack Farr was still able to register his real estate on the score sheet, registering 2 goals and 4 assists in the loss.
Last week we talked to Pete Moosberger and Derek Dane heading into the Johnny Tommy game. St. Thomas coming away with the 9-6 win. Who would you say was the unsung hero of the game?
Well, when I take a look at the box score, Terry, who really stands out to me is Joe Palermo, a Quinnipiac transfer who came to St. Thomas last year, a former NCAA Division I player helping the St. Thomas Tommies win an MCLA Division II national championship. He was 3 of 4 on faceoffs. He added an assist and got 2 GBs. So the scoring was pretty much even balanced between Will Hurstman and Clevin and Carbonell, which we've come to expect. So a two-way middie like Palermo, who also sees time in the faceoff X to see what he does play into the game effectively. I think that he's more or less the unsung hero of this year's regular season Tommy Johnny game.
You've been on the sideline for many a BYU Colorado State battle, and Colorado State really ran away with this year 16-5. What would you attribute that to?
I think I would firstly attribute it to our Division I Player of the Week receiving Franklin's 15 minutes of fame, Casey Carter, who I believe we gave the honor to last year as well. This is a player who's really known more for scoring than assisting, and obviously when you take a look at the seven-goal-two-assist effort he produced against BYU, 9 points in a single game of that magnitude is very impressive. And Carter has really been doing a good job of being a little bit less selfish this year and distributing the ball more. So the 2 assists really stand out to me as well. And, you know, we talked to Coach Schneck early in the year, and what he attributes to their recent struggles with Colorado State is their stifling defense. They work a 2-goalie system. You know, they arguably have one of the best long stick middies in the league, and, you know, 3 really aggressive close defense that just really know the BYU offense in and out. And considering that BYU is kind of trying to create a new offensive identity now that Ted Ferrin has graduated, I think that's what you could really attribute the lopsided meeting to. But I really wouldn't put too much investment into this. They're going to play each other again in the Rocky Mountain Lacrosse Conference Championship and then probably once more in the MCLA Championship. I was there the last time BYU beat Colorado State in the 2011 semifinals when BYU, of course, went on to win their first national championship in the post-Jason Lamb ever. So in the post-Jason Lamb era. So that being said, we could easily see BYU rectify this result later on this season.
We just spoke with 2 SCLC D2 coaches, so it's a little bit on the brain. How many D2 SCLC teams are going to make the MCLA tournament?
As of right now, as long as Palm Beach Atlantic, the number 6 team in the country, does not lose to Florida Gulf Coast, the number 12 team in the country, who's at this point on the bubble out, the 3 top teams, number 5 Liberty, number 6 Palm Beach Atlantic, and number 8 Elon, should all make the tournament, assuming one of those 3 win the SCLC title and that Palm Beach Atlantic doesn't lose to Florida Gulf Coast.
If you were on the MCLA tournament committee, would you give Sam Houston State an at-large bid this year, considering that the Lone Star Alliance does not have a D2 AQ?
You know, with their 14-12 win over Elon, and for that matter, the win that Elon recently picked up over Briarcliff, I guess, you know, by numbers and association, they probably deserve it. But the real question is, you know, how good of a use are they going to make of their time at the 2013 MCLA tournament? When you look at how the Bearcats have performed in seasons past, 2010 got paired up with St. Thomas, 2011 with Grand Valley, and 2012 with Dayton. Those are obviously tough draws, but the way that those teams were able to put up 20 goals on the Bearcats and the way that the Bearcats were only held to single digits in each of those games, I mean, that more or less compares to the way that St. Thomas, Grand Valley, and Dayton compete to the middle or lower end of the respective UMLC CCLA. So, that being said, do they deserve it? Yes. But at the end of the day, like pretty much every other tournament that they've gotten into with a Division II AQ, you could probably find a team somewhere in the Midwest or the SCLC, or even for that matter, further out west that would probably compete better in those first rounds, 14-16 seeding matchups.
Sonoma, the owner of the most surprising results of the weekend, plays at Cal Poly on Saturday and, at UCSB on Sunday. You got a prediction for those 2 games?
that's a really tough road trip for Sonoma, and the Seawolves are obviously on a little bit of an upswing coming off of the win over Stanford. And, you know, we've talked about Cal Poly, a team that was the number one seed in last year's tournament and earned their way into the championship game against Colorado State, where they just fell short. I think that Sonoma is going to beat Cal Poly 10-4. I think that Sonoma will hopefully go deep into their bench and utilize some resources. But again, that's a tough two-game road stretch. And then they go over to play UCSB in an old-school WCLL matchup. Obviously, a different story now since UCSB split down into the Southwestern Lacrosse Conference. But the Gauchos have had a little bit of an easy going with their opponents lately in the lighter part of their schedule, and I think that that's gotten their confidence up. They'll be going up against the Sonoma team coming off against a tough game with Cal Poly. So I have UCSB 11-9 taking that victory.
You mentioned, obviously, Cal Poly, one of the stories of the season last year, and you predicted them to suffer a loss this week. Do you think they, and then Minnesota Duluth, another interesting historical program, at least over the last 5 years in the MCLA, do you think those two teams are tournament teams?
Minnesota Duluth is in a similar situation to that of Sam Houston State, considering that they've lost their AQ. So Minnesota Duluth at this point is kind of riding off of Cal Poly's success, considering Duluth beat Cal Poly earlier in the season. So in order for Cal Poly to get into the tournament, they need to win the WCCL title over a very competitive field that includes Cal, Stanford, and Sonoma State. As far as Minnesota Duluth is concerned, if Cal Poly is able to pull out the WCLL championship, that will certainly help their chances. But I think it's kind of doubtful for the Bulldogs, unfortunately. They have an outside shot if, you know, Illinois or Wisconsin win the GRLC, which one of them should. You know, it's tough times for Duluth considering the situation that the conference is in. I think the UMLC should work really, really hard next year to get another team into Division I while remaining with their current Division II format. So both of them have the minimum number of teams to get the AQ bid to Nationals. Because truthfully, Duluth is too good of a historical team to really deserve to be left out of this year's tournament. They were the 16 seed going up against Cal Poly, the one seed in last year's MCLA tournament. And Duluth took them to overtime. So the amount of parity that the Bulldogs are able to create really speaks to their ability, but it's just really bad timing with the loss of Marquette in their conference and how that affects their AQ or lack thereof.
BC is the top-ranked Pioneer League team. Do you consider them to be the favorite for the Pioneer League championship?
Well, similarly to the SCLC, I actually think that the Pioneer League is one of those conferences where really anybody can beat anybody on a given day. There's a lot of parity in that conference, and as it's shaking up right now, I think that the Pioneer League is really likely a one big league where the champion can easily be Boston College, UConn, Northeastern, or even Buffalo, who we've seen slip off a little bit lately, more or less the strongest team out of that conference since the Bulls transitioned out of the CCLA. So all that being said, I think that it's a wide open competition. BC is easily the favorite. They have the opportunity to ride at large success from their victory over the University of Texas earlier this year, considering that they are the Lone Star Alliance favorite, which does get a Division I AQ. But it's really wide open, Terry. Northeastern, UConn, Buffalo, any of them could go.
Any chance the SCLC gets more than one bid to Greenville at the D1 level?
Well, right now I would say that Georgia is obviously the front runner for the SCLC title. They're actually making an atypical out-of-conference late-season road trip out to Colorado where they'll play both Colorado State and Colorado. So if they're able to make magic and pull out a win in either of those games, they'll certainly secure themselves in that large bid and, for that matter, allow another SCLC team to get into the tournament if they are unable to win the SCLC Division I title. But it's just a league with a lot of parity. I think that Georgia's the front runner. I don't see them being very successful in Colorado. And for that matter, I do see them being the favorite to win the SCLC championship. But Clemson, who beat Georgia, gave Georgia their one loss early this year, is going to go into the SCLC tournament with a high seed. Florida State is unranked but dangerous with Luke Donovan running their offense. And, you know, you can never sleep on Virginia Tech either. So Georgia's the front runner, but it's certainly a one-bid league, and it seems that way, and it really could go to any of those teams similar to the Pioneer League.
George Washington got three wins early and kept things close with Pitt, but now they're in the middle of a five-game losing streak. What's going on with them?
Terry, I would really say that it's mostly transitional issues. Much like Quint referenced in the Michigan-Hopkins game on ESPNU earlier this year. You know, some of those Michigan former MCLA athletes, you know, just quite didn't know what they were expecting when they transitioned into NCAA Division I and the sort of commitment that was going to require and the extra work that was going to translate from MCLA success at the highest level to, you know, just trying to have really any sort of success at the NCAA level, as Michigan has kind of been struggling in their first 2 years. And when it comes right down to it, I think that George Washington is, I'm not saying having an NCLL hangover, but, you know, they're just transitional issues. I think that some people and the current student athletes just weren't really sure of, you know, how much more of a seriously the MCLA is compared to the NCLL, the high level of competition in the SELC, the amount of practice time that is required to be successful at the Division I level in the MCLA. And, it's also a very tough time of year academically for George Washington, similarly to Emory and Stanford and Cal and some of the other better schools that exist scholastically in this league. We're approaching finals times, and obviously for some of the older student-athletes, academics is, of course, the priority. So, you know, just some transitional issues, but at the end of the day, Joe Opperin, who is one of the best players in Oakland and, for that matter, MCLA history. If there was an MCLA Hall of Fame, Coach Opperin would be in it. He's doing a good job recruiting. He knows what the MCLA is about. He knows the transitional issues he's been dealing with. And I think in the next 2 to 3 seasons, you'll see this Colonials program really turn around.
Well, Dave, that's a good place to stop. You mentioned the academic demands of this league and, you know, particularly the idea that so many of the nation's best universities have their lacrosse teams playing in the MCLA is something to consider as well when it comes to the academic component of the workload that these players put in. And as on that note, I want to make sure that everybody checks out your Franklin's Famous 15 student athletes in the MCLA. Is there anything in particular that you wanted to plug about this? Because I thought you did a lot of work, a lot of good research to come up with some fine names to include.
Well, Terry, I appreciate it. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, you were really the inspiration. We talked to Andy Garrigan in one of the, I believe, the second MCLA podcast of the season. We had Drew Virk first, and then we actually split the second podcast between Andy Garrigan from Texas and Dallas Hartley from Chapman. And, you know, Andy Garrigan gave us some really cool insight into his program. He was about to make, you know, their most important road trip out to the West Coast, and he actually had to proctor a science exam for one of his current student athletes. And the fact that the University of Texas allowed a club lacrosse coach to take the exam and one of those student athletes on the road, I think we both found to be very impressive in the way that it equates to the relationship between the university, the athletic department, and for that matter, the club sports department, and for that matter, the academic balance that comes with being an MCLA student athlete. Obviously, on the Division I side, their exceptions are made to have these athletes either take the test earlier or later on campus, but this was a really, really unique thing, and you know, you inspired me to take a little bit of a deeper look into the academic side of the MCLA. There's a lot of really unique institutions in this league, from those that, you know, are academically elite that you could find at the top of the U.S. News and World Report rankings. There are obviously schools, much like the service academies that we see from Army and Navy, also have ties to military institutions and very strict ROTC programs. And it was really a lot of fun reaching out to pretty much every coach in the country and seeing, you know, who was really getting it done both on the classroom as well as on the lacrosse fields. And, you know, over the course of the MCLA season and with the amount of teams that are in this league, there are a lot of programs that unfortunately get lost in the mix. So I think that we worked pretty hard here to give some recognitions to universities that we really haven't talked about yet. But, you know, just a lot of impressive things. As we had, as we spoke about with the Emory coaches earlier in the podcast, we're seeing an influx of grad students playing MCLA lacrosse. And, you know, that's a big commitment to make because this is really a step above of what you would normally consider with most other competitive club sports. As a matter of fact, coming off of the GW note, you're going to see a GW law student make the academic All-American inside lacrosse team this year. I mean, Terry, you got to think GW law school, it must be really hard to balance a lacrosse schedule with that kind of an academic commitment as well.
No question. And your point about, you know, how strong of an impression, you know, the Texas administration trusting Coach Garrigan to, you know, proctor an exam was, and how significant that is for, you know, this league, because to me, you know, one of the things about being an NCAA lacrosse player is the way in which your coach and the athletic support staff work with the players to make sure that they have the academic support they need. Now, in some instances, that might be a tutor. In other instances, it's reading time, you know, whatever the case may be. And in pretty much every instance, it's, you know, preferred scheduling and different types of excused absences, all of which are organized with different department chairs and professors. Well, in the MCLA, there really isn't any of that. So for, you know, these kids to be, you know, kind of excelling in the way that they are is definitely impressive and something that's worthy of note.
Yeah, no question. In addition to the GW law student, Patrick Rigney, we also did a good job of identifying some seniors who have some pretty impressive plans for next year going forward. And yeah, I mean, listen, this is something that I've been on both sides of. I played Division III NCAA lacrosse my freshman year at Drew University and worked really, really hard throughout the spring season to work with my professors and the athletic support staff in order to keep my grades in line so I could actually make the transfer to Emory. And it's a very interesting dynamic. So I really thank Andy Garrigan for sharing that story with us. There's more details about that in the article. And really, congratulations to these 15 MCLA Division I student athletes who have just done a great job both in the classroom and on the field this year. We also have some honorable mentions to discuss on the Division II side. It's very likely we'll see some kids from Emory on that list as well. And, you know, considering what we're taking into Spectrum this week, being an Emory alumni, seeing that program turn around under difficult academic circumstances and giving recognition to these kids, just a really, really special week in the MCLA right as we gear up for the postseason.
Well, Dave, that'll do it for the MCLA podcast this week. We appreciate you stopping by, checking us out on InsideLacrosse.com, on iTunes, search for Inside Lacrosse. And, you know, you can follow Dave on Twitter, dfranklin97. I am at Terrence Foy. And make sure to check out Franklin's most famous 15 student-athletes of the week on InsideLacrosse.com.
Terry, you know what I'm going to say. Cue the exit music.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.